One of the things that he bought us was a frame buffer. He bought us the first commercial 8-bit frame buffer from Evans and Sutherland. So the first thing I did, having been trained by Dick Schaaf, was sit down and write a paint program for it. So that's sort of the one son of Super Paint that was that figures in the story. And then a few months later, he came around and he said, "Well, what do we need to do to stay ahead?" And I said, "Well, if you got two more of these 8-bit frame buffers, we could gang them together and make a 24-bit frame buffer. One for red, one for green, and one for blue." And that took a lot of talking because you don't know what this guy... He doesn't talk rationally like most of you and I do. He was a nonlinear thinker in a very, very bizarre way. It's taken quite a while to describe, so I won't do it tonight. But eventually got the idea across to him that 24 bits, you could do all these, you could mix colors instead of having just a select set of colors. Got 16 million colors, which is essentially a continuum to human beings. And it can do all sorts of marvelous things. He goes away. We think he's got it, but we don't know. A few weeks later, he shows up and says, "Well, I got you five more of those frame buffers." So you could have two RGBs. Now, what that meant was this. The first frame buffer he bought from Evans and Sutherland was $80,000. 8-bit frame buffer, video resolution. The next five, we got a deal on, 60K each. So, $200,000, $1975, $200,000, $1975 for one RGB frame buffer, which is $1 million in today's money, easy. So what he said was, "I've just spent $2 million to give you this thing that I barely understand, do what you said you could do with it." These kind of guys don't come along too often. Well, what we did was we just blew out the envelope. We knew we were it's like what I imagine what an explorer landing on a new newly discovered land feels like. Gets to name everything. First guy there. We felt like that. We knew we were there first, and that everything we touched, every moment of the day, was the first of something that was going to last a long time. It was an extremely, extremely exciting time. In fact, we did not sleep until we had to. There were maybe 10, 15, 20 of us. This is "we" I keep referring to. People kept adding on. David DeFrancisco is certainly one of them. You would start the cycle. You know, you'd work until you drop, sleep a minimum amount of time, get up and work until you drop. You get into a kind of a natural, whatever your natural body cycle is, and it turns out to be 26 hours. So you slide with respect to the normal world in kind of an interesting way. But basically, we just wrote everything we could. And one of the things I wrote was Paint 3, the 24-bit, first 24-bit paint program that I'm going to show you in a few minutes here. It was really easy to write, which David Barkins here from the team of legal people who helped Adobe win a major lawsuit against patent suit against Montel, who insisted that they had invented this notion of airbrushing and soft edge brushes and so forth in the 1980s, whereas we knew good and well we had done it in the 70s, and not only that, but it was easy. It was so easy it never occurred to us that it was worth a patent. Turned out to be remarkably hard to prove without any evidence. And of course, during this highly creative time in the 70s, we weren't writing anything down. We were just going with everything. We were programming so fast you couldn't believe it. And making art. And every so often I would get called to this annual meeting of SIGGRAPH. I'm sure everybody here knows about. They'd write something down to go show buddies at SIGGRAPH. Thank God I wrote one paper in 1978 called Paint, where I just quickly described how the 8-bit paint program worked. And then I added an appendix on the end about how the Paint 3 worked. Just sort of a list of, but it was actual textual evidence that we had done this thing. It was sort of the only thing in existence during these patent suits decades later. In fact, I tried to help one small company in England against Quantel, and we lost. The English court, basically this Yank standing up saying we did it first, and the English Quantel company saying no, they didn't. And we had no proof except our word, which we couldn't believe they wouldn't take. And we lost, and I basically felt like I'd been called a liar. And I knew I wasn't a liar, that we really had done it first. So when Adobe came along, 94, approximately, and asked me to help them in the U.S. version of that patent suit, I said, well, sure, I'd be happy to help, but I want to win. Now, this has got to be taken off the backs of the computer graphics community. I don't want you to settle out of court, for example. I want this thing to go all the way, and you got to get some evidence. What evidence could there be? Well, the program itself would be the best evidence. Much to my amazement, I don't know, David, who's responsible, but somebody actually found the code at New York Tech, and it was all written in C, universal language, and a third party, could be me of course, the third party implemented my C code on Windows, and I showed this paint program in court. Slam dunk win. Well, let me show you what I showed the court. Okay, first, let me tell you what this really looked like. We had a color monitor. At New York Tech, we had a color monitor to show the picture, the painting, and there were a variety of different realizations of this idea. But at first we had a picture system to Evans and Sutherland, picture system to black and white calligraphic display that we used for a menu monitor. It's a real overkill for a menu monitor, but it was there, so I used it. So what this menu you see here would have been on a menu monitor, and that left-hand black area would have been on the, you know, on a standard video, RGB video monitor, studio monitor. That's Windows down to the bottom, of course. Really, all I did to make, the reason Paint 3 was easy to write was because I just took everything in Paint, the 8-bit version, and just tripled the code. Did the same thing in the red channel, the green channel, and the blue channel. It might have taken me a week, if it took that long. I went through the menu for Paint and stuck a 3 in every menu item. That's why the funny names are there. But with that addition, with those two channels, a whole world opened up that has made computer graphics real. Done under Windows. Well, no, the only thing that's been rewritten here was the display. All the software, and I actually looked at the software and verified it was my code. It exactly had my comments in it. There's even a secret button in here. I think this was one of the winning arguments. He said, there's a secret button in here. I don't think the guy who wrote the code, you know, compiled the code for Windows even knows here. And we showed the secret button. I don't remember where it is now. It's up there somewhere. Okay. You know what's selected here already? Okay. I'll pick a brush. One of the concepts in this paint program was that any picture could be a brush. Okay. Any shape could be a brush. But I had a whole bunch of them pre-saved in a brush directory. Let's pick out these here. And let me just be sure there's a color map here. Okay, now the one paint type of painting I'm going to spend time on tonight is wet paint, wet 3 paint. This is what I should have called airbrushing. I called it wet paint for reasons that don't need to concern us now, and that was actually a major legal battle over those words. But wet paint is what we would now call airbrushing. So let me show you how it works. Okay. Press on the menu item, palette pops up. Now I move over to that screen. I was actually changing screens and moving the mouse across the tablet. Select a color. palate disappears, and I better take my glasses off. Yeah. Well, let me just tap once, and you'll see that brush is opaque in the center and increasingly transparent as you get towards the edge. Another thing they claimed I couldn't do was that I could draw a stroke. Believe it or not, they said, nope, you can't. You did this to make a stroke. No, that'd be stupid, but, you know. We had to actually draw, you know, a stroke on the screen and show that it really worked. Just another color. Sorry. Some of the words I recall that I used in the trial while I was a witness was that when we showed this, when we demoed this to hundreds, if not thousands, of people at New York Tech, there's no big secret that we'd done this. Because, you know, one of the comments was that it felt like painting with ice cream. And let me see if I can actually make that happen. Let's see, magnify. By the way, choose the paint from anywhere on the screen. That was another part of our legal argument. Okay, now I've just done a video magnification by 4. You'll see as I paint around, the color just kind of smudge in. That's the part where it felt like painting with ice cream. If we actually had people. Did we have people stand up in court and say they remember saying that? I don't. Well, anyhow. You just get a picture from the era just for fun. This was when I discovered the proportions are wrong, by the way, because this was the original pixels were written into a video monitor which has non-square pixels. And of course, this Windows monitor has square pixels, so the proportions are a little squeezed, but, you know, just sort of in your mind, stretch it out. This is about the time where I discovered what became still my passion, and that's compositing, making art from compositing other pieces together, which I think was another thing Quantel claimed to have invented was digital compositing. No. And I think we even used this picture as an example of how we did digital compositing as an art form in the 70s. Didn't think twice about it. Here, for example, Jim Blinn had made this sphere program, and I glued some of his spheres together to make this flying saucer with a 3D rendering program. And Paul Zander was our background artist, the Hollywood-trained background artist for the animation studio there. He painted the back of the clouds, and I think he came in and painted the grasses later as a separate element. And my buddy David had taken a photograph of Stonehenge, and he digitized that photograph and color map shenanigans to make it look like a brass or chrome hinge, I think you called it. And I had come up with this French curve, this mathematical function that divides the screen up symmetrically and so forth. And there's a lot of components in here, but it was all put together to make this piece I call time.warp, which back before everybody put dots in names. You know, we were using the internet a long time ago. and also the Unix and the C language kind of inspired this notion of putting dots in names. So we had used dots in our names for a long time, but I used to kind of have to explain, no, the dot's supposed to be there. Right. And then there's another picture you might enjoy. I think it's... No. Again, in your mind, take the squeeze out. That's a picture of Alex Schur, the crazy madman and patron of New York Tech. I'm sort of surprised to find this picture here in this program when it showed up. So anyhow, that was the program that demonstration you've seen right there was the one that won this court case, slammed on five patents got thrown out. And, Adobe was not only didn't infringe, the patents were found invalid. It was that strong a case. And in fact, the jury wanted Quantel to be found guilty of defrauding the patent office. I think the judge threw that part out, but clearly the jury got it. And this was a jury that was high school trained at best. So there could be no technical talk. You basically had to say, this is what we did, you know. And about halfway through my testimony, I said, man, if it's up to me, I know we're going to win because all the jury is smiling at me. I went off to Italy. I remember somehow we had to move schedules around because I had an Italian holiday scheduled and I wanted to do this testimony, and so I gave it and then we jumped on a plane and went to Italy. So I didn't know how the trial came out. Ed Catmull, my colleague of many years, chased me down in some little village in Tuscany with the word, and I've already given it to you, that the jury had come back in. It was this tremendous win. It was a great vacation already, but that really put the icing on the cake. So I'm basically going to stop my history there tonight. I'm not going to go for hours. But I'd just like to add that my take on things is that here's the father of the paint program, wrote the first series 8-bit paint program. I wrote the first 24-bit program. I went to Lucasfilm, started up the Lucasfilm computer graphics division in 1980, and one of my first things was, well, we need to have a paint program here. I hired Tom Porter, whom I knew. Oh, New York Tech had sold the 8-bit version of this program to Ampex. And in fact, that was in 76, and in fact, I came out and spent a month in December 76 getting this 8-bit version of the program working at Ampex. Okay. And by the way, I was in this horrible motel room there, and this while sitting there bored out of my mind, I finally said, when I get back to New York, I'm going to write the 24-bit version of that program. That's where I did it. I even found some notes since then that say that, but I didn't have for the trial. Tom Porter worked at Ampex on the son, it's called Ava, a son of Paint, which is the son of Superman. And so I knew Tom, knew my style, and so I hired him, one of my first hires at Lucasfilm. He wrote the first 32-bit Paint program, which includes an alpha channel and everything. And that's why the three of us shared the Academy Award for being the original contributors of Paint Systems to the movie business. Okay, I'd be happy to take questions. Yeah? Well, the computer graphics at NYIT petered out after several years. Well, part of it was because the whole bunch of us left and came to Lucasfilm. You know, Ed and I came first, and then we slowly started pulling in some of our favorite people, you know, but over time. There was a contingent there for quite a while, Pat Hanrahan, and I didn't overlap, for example. He was at New York Tech. So it continued to be a lab for, I don't know, 10 more years? But I believe it's kaput now. Alex Schur got booted out of the presidency by his son. But he showed up at the 25th SIGGRAPH for what was called a digital fireside chat, something like that, digital campfire, that was devoted to New York techies. And they all sat around this digital campfire, and there was Uncle Alex himself, whom a lot of us hadn't seen in decades probably, on the stage, just as, well, just as wacky as ever. I don't know where these words are going to go, you know. It's true. I mean, the guy, he was a very strange man. I mean, I think he actually thought that if you poured money in to these machines, that if you poured programming into these machines, dollars would just pour out the other side. You could just sort of skip the movie in the middle. And maybe that will become true, but he was way ahead of his time. And he, you know, we have to give him lots of credit, no matter how zany he was, because he did it. He let us build the first world-class computer graphics laboratory in the world. It was a mecca. Everybody in the world who knew anything about computer graphics found their way to that lab. And that's why it was so funny when the Quantels tried to stand up in court and say, "Oh, it was a secretive place. They wouldn't let anybody in." Are you kidding? We wanted to show everybody what we were doing. It was so exciting. As far as I know, Alex Schur is still alive and well, and there's no computer graphics research at New York Institute of Technology. New York Institute of Technology, by the way, was kind of a 12th-rate institute of learning with this first-rate computer graphics laboratory. And the best example I have of its quality was its bookstore sold auto parts. Tires, batteries were in the window display. I'm not kidding, because kids who couldn't get into, you know, regular colleges on Long Island would live with mom and dad and drive in, and so cars were the important thing. Now, it may have changed a lot since then, but that's what it was like when I was there. Yeah. Question for Dick as well?
Icon-based menu, I don't know, it just seemed natural, seemed like a good idea at the time.
It was obvious.
It was obvious. I don't know. I'm sure we weren't the first ones to think about it either. There are a lot of things like that just seemed natural, and not just to me or just to us. I mean, there were a lot of things that were obvious to do at this point, and as I said, it was a confluence of events. There were a lot of ripe fruits, low-hanging fruit on the tree, made possible by the progress of integrated circuits, among other things, by the presence of a place like Xerox PARC and New York Tech and so on, which we benefited from. And I don't think any of these things that were done in that period were profound or even very hard. They were, in many cases, just the obvious things to do next. And someone was willing to support people who wanted to do those things that they saw as the next obvious thing, and we benefited from that. But someone else would have done it next within 2 weeks, probably, if we hadn't. So I don't know about the icons. It just seemed like a natural thing to do. I was getting awful tired of typing commands by that time, as we all were for many years thereafter as well. And
it's kind of a whole push at Xerox PARC with the graphic interface.
Right, that was, well, as you know well, it was one of the big themes at PARC was a graphical display, a two-dimensional display, an interaction through pictures and gesture and so on. Damon Rare. There were a bunch of these things. It's an obvious idea in general, the paint system. There were a number of them that made their way into the video biz because it was clear that the high end of the graphics world was in television graphics, and people were willing to pay for such things. So Ampex had the first commercial paint system called Ava that Alvy mentioned was basically his code. And then there were others that followed. Quantel had been working on this kind of thing, an image manipulating frame buffers around the same time. And they made a very successful paint system. But there were lots of others. Dubner is one of them. And New York Tech had a little company which made or spin-off, which made paint systems for graphics, graphic arts as well.
Let me just say in Quantel's behalf that system they built was beautiful. And what made it so beautiful was it was done in hardware. Back in the days when software just couldn't do what they did, they put it in the hardware, and it was a beautiful implementation. Which is one of the points I made in the court cases. So this is not against, they deserve full credit for that. It's just that the notion of soft edge brushes isn't there. That's all. They did a great job, though, and they deserve all they got for that. They made a lot of money for that, for one thing, and got an engineer, at least.
I'm working at Interval Research, a think tank founded by Paul Allen and David Liddell. And the moment working on reconfigurable computing, something like my PhD thesis was about cellular automata. And it's once in a while people give us credit for thinking far ahead in the future, but hardly anybody asks, what are you thinking about now? You know? Well, that's one of the things, reconfigurable computing.
My latest thing is I just got a Nikon D1, if you know what that is. It's Nikon's first serious professional level digital camera, and I'm totally in love with it, and I can't stop taking pictures. And I think my natural loving photography as I do, and being a digital whiz as I am, it seems like a natural place to go is to make art in that world. And I think I have some new ideas to bring to it. Try one out on you. It's that with digital photography, there's no longer any need for a rectangle. And I think just that one idea might keep me busy the rest of my life. By the way, I retired from Microsoft 3 months ago. I'm not working there anymore. I think it's a great company, even though it's politically incorrect to say so, I guess. Yeah, I thought a lot about digital television. In fact, one of the things I did during my 5 years at Microsoft was to go to Washington and try to fight for some sane digital television standards. One thing that's insane is interlace, and they're still trying to foist interlace on us. It's just unbelievable that we finally had a chance to get rid of that nightmare. And well, the one thing I've learned is it's frightening to see how Washington makes technical decisions. It's made with economics and politics in mind rather than good science. It's really scary. And every scientist stands up and says, this is nuts to have interlaced, but we were losing. I'm not the least bit surprised. To me, the expense is the interlace, they keep trying to foist this extremely expensive old technology on the American public, whereas most everybody in this room probably looks at a piece of non-interlaced digital video every day. It's called a computer monitor. It's well understood. It can be made cheaply, especially in mass quantities. But there's this, economic interest that I won't name, but I'm pretty sure I know, that want to see this old interlace idea shoved down the consumer's throat. My fear is that it's just going to wipe out digital television before it gets started, because people just won't pay 10 grand for a box or 6 grand. To me, it's a fat pipe in everybody's house, a digital pipe in everybody's house at 20 megabits. Wow. Broadband. Think about broadband. Anything else? I think we better let you go see the collection. Well, I mean, you're right there. You couldn't patent software. Although, there were ways around that. If you really, really wanted to patent software back in the 70s, there were people who, I forgot the tricks they used, but there were ways to do it. But generally, you thought, if it's software, I can't patent it, so you didn't think about it. The reason we didn't think about it was because we thought the ideas were simple and didn't deserve patents. We still think that. Should people patent now? As a person who started companies on intellectual property, I can certainly see the point of a little protection so you can get out there and exploit it for a while.
That's an invitation to a long discussion. We better not start, I think. So, thank you very much. Thanks to the Computer Museum.
These stories and insights are priceless. Thank you very much. It was a great privilege to have you come and share them with us tonight. Appreciate it. Now I would like to tell you how to find Superpaint. Once you walk out the front, you turn right, and it's about one city block walking up the street, and you will see our warehouse, and you will also have a chance to talk not only with Dick and Alvie some more, but there are three members of the 1620 Restoration Project here, Joe Frederick, Dave Bapp,